Chapter 3. Dreams of Order. Cracked. Unscarred.
There has to be another reason, said Cord,
taking the optics from his eyes and massaging the bridge of his nose.
Stands to reason.
He looked up at the face of Colonel Augustus Fask and wished the man was not there. The other officer looked like he had been soaked and then hung out to dry. A damp sheen clung to Fask's jowly face, and his Yurnian officer corps uniform looked like he had slept in it many times over and never washed it. But then there was little enough water in the shelter complex to drink, let alone ensure that uniforms were cleaned and pressed. Even if you were a command-level officer with strategic control, you wore the same uniform for months. After a while, you just stopped noticing the smell. Fask had turned up in Cord's cramped billet, with a smile and a bottle of liquor, an hour after Cord had got through decontamination. The bottle was already a third empty, and Fask's breath was rank with the smell of the spirit as he settled into the folding chair opposite Cord.
"Terror, Silas. This is how you relax now."
Fask's eyes were skating over the maps laid out over the folding table next to Cord's cot. Inked lines crossed the maps in different colours. Notes in neat printed hand filled the spaces next to areas marked with circles. Cord wished he'd been able to put them away before Fask had started reading them.
"Everything all right?"
asked Fask after a long pause.
"I mean, you holding together?"
Cord shrugged. He was very, very tired. He did not want to sleep, but he did not want to talk to Augustus Fask either. They had ridden war machines together back on Yearn, and then on Iconis. They were both squadron commanders then, younger, and full of the more comfortable sort of lies that went with a soldier's life. Cord supposed that history allowed Fask to think of him as a friend. Only problem was he did not like the man. Never had. And Fask was not there to check he was all right, at least not in a friendly sense. Cord stood and made to fold the maps up. Fask put his glass down on the maps as Cord reached for them. Some of the liquid slopped over the chipped rim of the glass and began to pool on the parchment.
"I mean it, Silas. Is everything all right?"
Cord took a step back and controlled the stab of anger needling at the back of his eyes. He reached into a pocket in his fatigues and found a low stick. He turned away as he lit the stick.
"I wound up sitting on my hands on a backwater world while the rest of creation tore itself apart."
He sat down on the folding chair and breathed out a slow, smoke-heavy breath.
"That planet gets virus-bombed. The Iron Warriors decide to turn the sludge that's left into a battleground. Then our side decide to get in the fight. I get my command all but wiped out in what was, until last night, our biggest defeat. And we are still rolling around trying to break an enemy that has made its reputation out of being unbreakable."
He paused, nodded to himself as if satisfied.
"And we have no idea why they are here or why it started. So yeah, everything is all right."
Fask sat down on Cord's bunk, his glass back in his hand.
"We don't need to know answers to fight,"
said Fask, and took a gulp.
"No,"
Cord nodded.
"But it might help if we want to win."
Fask shook his head, picked up the bottle and began to pour himself a fresh measure. After a second, he snorted and raised the bottle to Cord. The oily liquid splashed against the bottle sides. Cord shook his head. Fask grunted.
"Well, you really are as twisted around as they say."
Fask put the bottle down. He wrapped both hands around his refilled glass, but did not raise it to his mouth. All pretense of humour had gone from his face.
"The Central Command's worried about you." "I thought it might be something like that,"
nodded Cord carefully.
"Look, it's just the way it is. This theory of yours worries them."
"Worries them?"
Cord raised an eyebrow.
"How?"
"All this stuff about why the enemy are here, about there having to be another reason. You keep it to yourself, sure, but people talk, and in this place..."
Fask gestured at the cot, table and chair pressed between bare rockcrete walls and the metal slab of the door.
People here. People talk. Is that why they sent you? To stop me thinking about it.
Cord looked at the floor so that Fask would not see the anger he could feel boring out of his eyes.
You know where I've been. 18 hours in a machine, 6 going out, 6 in direct engagement, 6 coming back, while the Iron Warriors try and turn our loss into a victory slaughter.
He stopped and nodded, his face set into a frown as though considering deeply.
Good timing.
Fask was shaking his head, impatience seeping from him as he sighed.
You know, this was meant to just be a friendly talk.
Cord nodded and tried to make his face reasonable, moderate, calm.
When did you last ride a machine, Fask?
He asked softly.
On the surface. You know, that place up there with the dead people and the gunfire.
Throne, Silas.
Fask stood, stepped to the door and yanked it open.
You know what? Do what you like. I look forward to reading the discipline report.
After a second, Cord got up, closed the door and sat down at the table. Carefully, he dabbed at the pool of spirit, which had blurred the ink of the map. He stared at the lines, circles and notes again. It was incomplete. There was only so much information on engagements with the Iron Warriors and their allies that he could get hold of. But even so, it meant something.
Searching, he said to himself.
Carefully, he reached under his cot and pulled a bottle out. The liquid inside was honey gold and clung to the bottle's sides as he unscrewed the top and took a swig. He inhaled sharply, then took another gulp. He nodded again to himself.
Searching.
They took Herend back to the silence of sleep. He had walked from the field of battle as the fog had begun to lighten with the coming of dawn. Far below the earth, in the caverns of the sightless warrens, the adepts and tech marines had begun to pull his machine body apart. He wondered if others of his kind thought of it as a relief. That had been how some of the tech priests had talked of it when he had been amongst the living. A release from the pain of an existence snatched from death, a return to the peace of oblivion. Herend did not think of it that way. They took his power to move first, shutting down his neural connections to the dreadnought frame, so that the impulse, which would have moved an arm or lifted a leg, now did nothing. Ghosts of his old limbs returned to him, the feeling of his left arm twitching, the fingers itching, even though they were no longer there. They took sight and sound after that. Silent blackness enclosed him with the suddenness of a disconnected plug. Those were the moments that were the worst. In the silence, he could imagine himself as nothing, just a tangle of stray thoughts and ghost sensations held in a box. What was worse was that in those moments he thought he should be angry, but instead he felt empty. And then, at last, they would drown his thoughts with sedatives and give him to his dreams. The dreams were his home now. Sometimes he went back to Istvan and burned again. Sometimes he felt pain. Sometimes he forgot that it was a dream and thought that he was dying again. When it ended, he would try and remember the feeling of moving, of breathing, of being alive. He dreamed of the past. He dreamed of how he'd become an Iron Warrior. He tasted the blood in his mouth again and felt the razors filleting skin and muscle from his bones. The pain was a sea of ice and burning acid. There was no relief. To endure was to become stronger. He had looked up into the apothecary's metal mask and seen his own reflection in the circular lenses. His heart had beat in the open cavity of his chest.
"What do you wish?"
the apothecary had asked, the ritual words rising over the sounds of the bone saw.
"To be iron," he had gasped through his own blood.
They had given him his wish. He dreamed of the fields of 1,000 battles, the ground chewed by shellfire, the flesh of the dead pulped into the mud. He saw faces he had never realized he would remember. He saw his life jumbled into chunks of color and sound and smell, and they were more real than waking. He had died on Istvan V. His flesh had boiled in his armor. They had clamped his dying flesh at the heart of a body of pistons, plastile, and servos. They had woken him for the first time and told him that he would serve the Legion still. They had given him a new name, one cut from his old name, like a word formed by mutilation. He had become iron for a second time. He remembered all this and lived it again, screaming mutely as the unsettled tides of sleep came up to meet him. He struggled for an instant, then fell, and fell. The true world snapped back into being, sharp and unforgiving. He felt his nerves mesh with the machine again, felt the silence form around him. He was waking again. His fall into oblivion halted. A voice came to him out of the dark, crackling with static.
"You rise again, Ironclad. The Primarch has called you to him."
The fourth Primarch's words were false, incomplete in truth value.
Argonis did not bother to open his eyes to look at Sota Nul. The servitors were peeling his armor from him piece by piece, muttering in their machine voices as they moved around him. They did not like being near Sota Nul, he could tell. They moved like curbed animals whenever she came close. He couldn't say he blamed them. He didn't like being near her either. The room was large, its floor polished rockcrete, its walls brushed metal, and the light came from globes floating in bronze cages. Red fabric softened the hard lines of the walls and hung over the straight-backed chairs. Statuary, a rare thing to see in the presence of the Iron Warriors, stood in the room's recesses, the features of each sculpture bluntly stylized. The chamber was amongst the more luxurious living quarters he had seen aboard a 4th Legion ship. The points was not lost on Argonis. He was honoured. But he was different, softer, not of the iron. Argonis felt the cool air of the chamber touch his skin as the servitors released the plating from his torso. The armour was sea-green and black, Chthonian kill glyphs spidered across the plates in beaten gold wire. A burnished crest of wings spread across the chest plate, and enamelled laurels ringed the brows of his helm. A bolt pistol and gladius hung at his waist, the grips of both decorated by mirror coins. Black tattoos of wings and the geometric lines of Chthonian ganglyphs ran across the muscle beneath his armour shell. To anyone who had been born in the warrens of Chthonia, his skin would have shouted his past, from the kills he had made in his youth to the honours he had won as a warrior of the 16th Legion. A killer, they would have read. Nightwalker, oath-taker, and one who has won loyalty through blood. Crescent wings spread across his neck and shoulders, a full moon set between their feathers. That last symbol told that he was chieftain of the Isidis flight, the pilot cadre oath-bound to the First Company elite. Pale scars crossed the flesh of his arms, back and chest, the hair-fine lines hatching his skin. The Unscarred, they called him. Half in reference to the fact that his face was untouched by war, and partly in ironic reference to the years of knife bouts which had left their razor marks on his body. He flexed his shoulders, and the inked feathers rippled.
"Do you not concur with my truth analysis?"
Sota Nul asked, and a prickling of his skin told him that she was looking directly at him.
"Perturabo lied about his war."
"A Primarch's reasons and motivations are their own," he said. "They are beyond truth and falsity."
"I have shut the ears of all who would listen to us. We can speak openly."
"I was. Perturabo speaks the truth, in part, at least. Talan is important, or could be, and he has never failed to answer the War Master's bidding before."
"That view does not match your actions. You have summoned the operative. Why, if all is as it seems?"
The last plates of his armour came away, and he felt the fabric of a tabard slip over his neck. Sota Nul was looking at him. The cluster of 9 lenses on the left side of her dead flesh face glowed green in the low light.
"Nothing is as it seems," he said carefully.
A sudden scratching made both turn. Prophecius was moving, each step a sinuous transition between instances of complete stillness. A blank mask covered his head in its entirety, the metal scored with symbols which Agonis did not understand and did not like to look at. A lock-like mechanism held the mask shut at the back of the head. The key from that mechanism hung around Agonis's neck, its presence a promise he wondered if he would have to keep. Hands had appeared from beneath Prophecius's green silk robes. The fingers on each were withered and twisted, as though they had been broken and healed before they were set. His right hand clutched a tablet of wax set in a silver frame. A long metal spike capped the index finger of his left. After a pause, he stabbed the spike down into the wax. His head was lolling back, his hands moving as though pulled by wires.
"He is marked."
The gouged letters showed clear on the pale wax. Prophecius paused, once again utterly still. Argonis stared at the astropath, and then at the words on the tablet. He had no idea what they might mean. Blood was oozing from the edge of Prophecius's nails, running down onto the wax tablet.
"Will you refer to the Primarch? To Perturabo?"
Prophecius's hand jerked to life again, slashing words into the wax.
"The eye has seen him. He has passed through it. Has seen him. He has seen..."
Argonis opened his mouth, a question forming on his tongue. Sota Nul flinched, as though woken from sleep by a sudden noise. Argonis turned to her.
"Return signal from Alpharius's asset received," she began.
"I thought this area was shrouded," he growled.
"Signal confirms contact,"
she continued, shaking her head as though struggling to hear. Then she looked up at Argonis, the light in her 9-fold eyes hard and bright.
"He will come to us."
She passed the time by breaking the Alpha Legion communication ciphers. It had been 16 hours since Io had folded herself into the crawl space, and she estimated that it would be another 8 until she moved. Stillness was the key to invisibility. That truth was one of the first lessons taught in the assassin temples on Terra. Another strategy might have been to move continually, to make herself impossible to pin down. That strategy had merits, but most of them applied when you had somewhere to go. At present, she had no location to reach, and getting out of the Crescent shelter would be difficult, bordering on impossible. Not actually impossible, of course, but that was the way it might seem, based on probabilities of detection stroke death. She was hunted, and she needed to stay alive if she was going to complete her mission. So she had scrambled down into the deep reaches of the shelter, where the tunnels were choked with cables and pipes, and the dust and grime told its own story of how many had made the journey before her. The feeds from the cordon of netflies were showing nothing concerning. Air temperature, sound levels, and vibration were all steady at background levels. The multifaceted eye of the swarm showed her nothing other than empty shafts, ducts, and tunnels. Everything was quiet. There, folded into a space small enough that even a child would struggle to reach her, she waited and ran codes through her partitioned mind. She needed to watch the swarm of netflies, which currently watched every connection to her current location, but that only took half of her awareness. Cracking the Alpha Legion's comms had seemed a good use of the rest of her mind. It had taken her a few awkward minutes to activate and expose the workings of the comms implants she had taken from the dead operatives. 2 of her flies had bitten into the blood-slicked machine, and encrypted communications had begun to flood her awareness. The data was most likely low-level, nothing big, nothing of critical importance, but she existed to make lethal situations from tiny fragments. Besides, cracking the ciphers gave her something to do. The Mechanicum of Mars now claim the realm of technology and its mysteries as theirs, and theirs alone. But the traditions and mysteries which would become the assassin temples had been born in Old Night, and they had secrets of their own. The Red Priests might claim dominion over the machine, logic and calculation, but Vanus were not machines. They were the powers of human reason refined to a sharp point, and they lived for information. It was not just a skill or training, or even the modifications made to their brains by razor, gene graft, and alchemistry. It was a compulsion, a drive burned into her that she had to satisfy. There were sacred logic engines on Mars which would have cracked the ciphers, machines which would have creaked and wailed to the same solution, but they lacked the human component that the Vanus so treasured. They lacked obsession. The cipher was complex, even for covert communications. She enjoyed knowing that. It made watching it fall apart more satisfying. It took her 5 hours. When she cracked it at last, she allowed herself a few moments for the data to wash around her senses. It felt like light, like fresh water and warm air. The comms unit was not picking up transmissions anymore, but fragments of what had passed through it still remained, scattered like shards of a shattered window. She dipped her mind into them, noting, collating, and archiving. There was some value. Her mind stopped dead. Then her heart began to hammer. Blood flushed into her brain as lines of deduction and possibility began to form, combine, and expand. She had to move. She had to get out of the shelter, no matter how. She began to squeeze back out of her bolt hole. Once able to crawl, she began to move faster. Once she could run and climb, she was a blur of black sin skin rising through the depths of the shelter. The lines of computation in her mind spun on, hungering for more data, promising conclusions. At the core of each accelerating thought, the single fragment of Alpha Legion's signal echoed and glowed like a message written in fire. The emissary has arrived.